Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this talk, which is another in our LSE Ideas series. I should just introduce myself, Christopher Coker. I'm a director of LSE Ideas. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome back old friend, Ned LeBeau, who I have known for many years. He's professor of political theory just across the road at King's College London. He's also BITE professor at Pembroke College, Cambridge. And one of his books, let me get it, Avoiding War, Making Peace, yes, has just been voted one of the top 100 books of last year. Now, Ned is a polymath, so you won't have come across someone like him. Well, you won't very often come across someone like him. He's written on many subjects. War, counterfactual history, political theory, of course, philosophy of science, and two novels, A Murder Mystery and Science Fiction. But I think one of my favorite books of his, which came out a few years ago, has an intriguing title, and it's taken from the Onion newspaper, which had a history of the 20th century, and each year showed a mock New York Times front page, and the one for November the 12th, 1918, was War Ends. Millions dead, kings go into exile, empires collapse, and then at the very bottom of the page there's a little article, Archduke Franz Ferdinand found in hiding in Sarajevo. So your title was The Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives. And this is an alternative history of the 20th century, which takes us all the way to the death of Marilyn Monroe, I think. Or does she die in this book?
Even beyond.
Even beyond. Anyway, that's not what you're here to talk about today.
It's,
alas, the rise and fall of political orders. Ned will talk for 45 minutes, and then will be a Q&A. And at the end of it, there will be a book signing. So if you'd like to buy one of his books, he'll be happy to sign and dedicate it to you. This will be a podcast. So if any of your friends, which we've had to turn away early this evening, would like to see it, it will be available. You've been given evaluation form, so please do fill those forms up and hand them back as you go out. And I think that's all I need to say. So, Ned, over to you.
Thank you. A question for you. Can I sit here?
No, absolutely.
And if that's the case, could you ask somebody to turn out that light? It's right in my eyes.
Yes. Can we do that?
No, it's not the overhead light.
Overhead.
It's the projector.
Projector light.
The overhead lights are fine. It's the projector that needs to go off. Thank you. Can people hear me? Am I close enough to the mic? Good. If there's a problem, just shout and I'll move closer. I think you probably have to do it at the computer. Take your time. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Christopher. LSE Ideas also sponsored a book launch for the predecessor of this book, A Cultural Theory of International Relations. The first book of the trilogy was called The Tragic Vision of Politics. I gave a lecture on that here, too. I also served as the Millennium Professor at the LSE for 2 years, so it's really, in a way, crossing the street is also coming home, because I worked here before. I worked there, and I did that because it's closer to the Café Delaunay. This third and final book of the trilogy asks why political orders form, how they stay afloat, why they decline and sometimes collapse. It takes on three very big questions and by definition can't offer a comprehensive account of how this happens, but focuses on what I think are critical dynamics and substantive features that are central to all three questions. Tonight, I'm going to talk a little about why orders form, and I'm going to do that because I'm primarily going to focus on the question of why orders fail. And I can't do that without saying a little bit first about why they form. Before I do that, I want to say a few words about the nature of political orders. One of the themes of the book is the distinction I make between top-down and bottom-up orders, which runs throughout the book. By top-down orders, governments are obviously the quintessential example of it, are orders, often political, but they don't have to be, for which there's a central authority, central enforcement. And while information and articulation for demands may float up, the decisions are made in a centralized way and then executed generally in a central way. Bottom-up orders, which generally describe most features of society as opposed to government, are more an emergent property. They're the result of behavior of multiple actors who may end up responding to one another, copying one another, developing a few simple rules about how they interact on a daily basis. Bottom-up orders tend to be far more robust and long-lasting than top-down orders. And bottom-up orders may pick up many of the features of top-down orders when they collapse. We see this in failed states, for example, or even in very weak states. I mean, consider Italy for hundreds of years, which has been a very weak state, but with a very strong society that performs many of the functions that otherwise a government might. But we should also recognize that some of the same activities can be characterized as either top-down or bottom-up. I give the example in the book of traffic. In the West, and certainly in the center of cities, in places like India and China, traffic is a top-down order. There are rules that are laid down about which side of the road you drive on, when you stop, who has the right of way. And you see the order that results. But if you go outside to the peripheries of these cities, you often see bottom-up orders. It looks chaotic to the foreign observer. People are going in both directions on both sides of the road, sometimes on the sidewalk, if there's a sidewalk. But in fact, there's order here. People are relating to everybody around them on the basis of a few simple rules. And the order that emerges is indeed an emergent property. One of the striking features of order, which I examine to some degree in my book, is what happens where top-down and bottom orders meet and interact. These are particularly important points of conflict, of resolution, and of insight into societies. And I give examples that range from schools to medical systems to political orders. And I'll just use the example of school here to give you an illustration of what I mean. If you consider primary schools almost anywhere in the world, inside the school building, it's a top-down order. Huh? There are rules about how students behave, even how teachers behave. There's a hierarchical authority that promulgates and enforces these rules. When you get outside, it's free play in the schoolyard. And games people play and what they do is an emergent property. It's a bottom-up order. And we know from a couple of studies that where we have the most conflict and physical contact is in the transitions between the bottom-up and the top-down, either going into school or coming out of school. The same thing can be documented in healthcare systems. And in part because the people who run it have a very different understanding of how it works, how it should work, and what values are important than the people who staff it. And when they meet, there's conflict. They can't talk to one another. They don't understand one another. They work by different procedures and rules. So this theme runs through my book. I'm not going to spend more time on it tonight, because rather I want to talk about why orders form and why they collapse. And I have two empirical examples in the book. There's a chapter, two chapters on the United States that ask the question, can a liberal democratic order survive? And there's a chapter on China, co-authored with Martin Dimitrov, who's a noted China specialist and my former colleague at Dartmouth. Obviously, I don't have the knowledge or the language skills to write about China. And I'll focus mostly on the U.S. tonight. If we look at why orders form, I start by looking at social orders among primates. There's been a lot of work, and it suggests, as does work on human societies, that human beings and many species of animals find it difficult, if not impossible, to live alone. For security, for social relations and intimacy, for acquiring status, they have to be part of a social order. And I mean, Aristotle is absolutely correct in this regard, and as you know, his description of politics begins with the description of man as a politikon zoon, a political animal. And here he's talking about top-down order, and he just takes for granted the need to have a bottom-up one. When we look at the animal societies that live in social orders, we find two striking things, that they all function according to two principles of justice. Now, obviously, animals don't articulate philosophy, but they act as if they had one. The two principles are equality and fairness. And each of these has a traditional meaning and a modern meaning. For the moment, I'm going to stay with the traditional meanings. Equality, isonomia in ancient Greek, is the sharing equally among members of the group that which is important, mostly food, but also sexual partners. And fairness is the principle that says the most rewards should go to those who contribute the most to the society. Now, I'll come back to these two principles later when I discuss human societies, but for the moment, in discussing animals, we see numerous examples of this, where there's an alpha male, whether it's a hyena or a baboon, that male is given first dibs at whatever food there is. If the group makes a kill, the animal is presented to him. But almost invariably, that alpha male then makes sure that the food is distributed equally among members of the society. So in this sense, equality and fairness are reinforcing. Some of you may have seen a little experiment that went viral online, conducted by Stavals, who is a Flemish ethologist but works in Florida, where he has a bonobo who's given a cucumber for performing a task, putting a stone in a box that's just outside of his cage. When he does it, he gets a cucumber. And this happens several times. And then Franz de Waals goes to the next cage where there's another bonobo who's asked to do the same thing. And, of course, the bonobo immediately does because he wants his reward. And he's given a piece of fruit. He then goes back to the first bonobo, who's seen what's happened with the second, asks him to do it again. He puts the stone in the box. He offers him a cucumber. And the bonobo takes the cucumber and throws it in anger at Franz de Waals. He's holding out for fruit. I mean, it's very clear what's going on here. We have any number of other experiments and observation that indicates that if alpha males abuse their position, that they lose support, that members of these primate groups are very careful not to hoard at the expense of the group because they would be punished. So there's a combination of both shame and physical punishment for violating principles of equality and fairness. These principles are absolutely central to human societies, too. They couldn't work without them. And no matter what cultural tradition you access, in early writings and philosophical writings, this is well understood. The question then arises, and I'm agnostic about the answer, do human beings instinctively behave this way because these are inherited propensities that we share with our animal species that are close to us and descend from a common ancestor? Or can we make the article of convergence? The only way to have a successful order is to have principles of justice which are enforced. So of necessity, social orders must function this way, quite independently of evolution. I don't know how you'd look for the answer. I'm not particularly interested in the answer. I'm much more interested in the finding. And what I suggest when I look at, hello, Peter, when we look at, please, there are reserved seats, when we look at human societies, I suggest that two things, that fairness and equality are found throughout human societies, that they have the traditional meaning that I've already described, but each also has a modern meaning. So fairness can not only mean you give the most to those who contribute the most, it can mean you give the most to those who need it the most. And if you remember Karl Marx, he tried to combine the two. Equality has its liberal definition, which is not equal distribution, but equal opportunity to compete for what people value. So these principles are still there. I make a second claim, which I don't think is more problematic, although it's certainly more controversial, and that is that all principles of justice can ultimately be reduced to either fairness or equality. Whether it's commutative justice, which has to do with procedures for doing things, once you look at what's debated, it either reflects fairness or equality. And that each of these principles, I further argue, is associated with, how shall I put this, a different human drive. Some of you will know that in cultural theory of international relations and also in tragic vision, I draw on what I call is the richer Greek understanding of the psyche, because it includes not only appetite, but thumos, which is generally translated as spirit, but what it really means is a universal human desire for self-esteem, which in some ways is more important than appetite unless we're starving. We'll wait to eat until everybody is seated, because not to do so would be impolite in many societies. Not in Italy, but certainly in Britain or the United States. No, in Italy you eat when it's hot, when the food is served. Different rule. Thumos We achieve self-esteem by excelling in activities valued by our peer group or our society. By winning their approbation, we in turn feel good about ourselves. Traditional societies everywhere tend to value fairness as much as they do equality, and even more. And traditional aristocracies, whether in Europe or China, or in any kind of warrior-based honor society, function on the basis of fairness. And just go read Aristotle and Plato to see how it's foregrounded, because this justifies an uneven distribution. And one of the features of all human societies, once you get beyond the size of a tribe or a kibbutz, is that you have an unequal distribution of whatever it is that people think important. One of the enigmas of social orders is how they survive with unequal distributions. Well, one way they do is the principle of fairness, which makes it appear just that you have unequal distributions, and that you benefit in many ways and more than you would otherwise, even though there are people who are still getting more. And this may be one reason why the lower down the hierarchy you go in most orders, whether bottom up or top down, the more support there is for the society, which seems otherwise enigmatic. Appetite gives rise to equality. And one of the big shifts in the modern world, which is readily documented and most recently by Ron Engelhardt in his new book, is that certainly from the 18th century on in the West, there was a shift away from fairness being the dominant principle of justice to equality. Now, these principles of justice are important because they justify existing hierarchies. And the fairness hierarchy is justified, as I said, on the basis of contributions. And appetite gives rise to hierarchies on the basis of conspicuous consumption. People make claims by having goods. I once saw a bumper sticker that he wins who dies with the most toys. I saw it on a rather large sailboat, which, of course, is very indicative of this attitude. So you have these different hierarchies with different principles of justice. And if we think now about how orders sustain themselves and collapse, in any order, we not only have a hierarchy, we have a considerable discrepancy between the practice of a society and the principle that justifies its hierarchy. And that creates problems for political orders. And what they do is devise discourses to justify or explain away this discrepancy. The two most famous in the West are the Garden of Eden story in the book of Genesis. Once Adam and Eve are expelled, all kinds of suffering results. And that becomes the justification for inequality, among other things. Hesiod's Works and Days offers the Greek version of this, and other cultures do the same. So I make a fundamental point about the survival and decline of orders, that there are long-term, underlying, longue durée, if you like, arguments that account for it, which is what I'm talking about here, and short-term ones. And the long-term ones, they're related. Shifts in the principles of justice, in their relative appeal, undermine orders. If you have an order that's based on fairness, but increasingly people come to accept equality, you run into problems. And secondly, if the discourses that justify discrepancy between theory and practice lose traction, you have problems. And very clearly, the 19th and 20th century have seen this dramatic shift, and there have been efforts to try to accommodate it even in international relations. And I suppose I should say a word about international relations. Think about the United Nations. The General Assembly is based on the principle of equality, one state, one vote. The Security Council is based on fairness. Those who contribute the most to maintaining order, allegedly, the great powers, have the most authority. And what's happening now, you have states like Brazil, India, Germany, Japan, who want permanent membership in the Security Council. And one of the things you see that I've looked at actually in a previous book, National Identifications and International Relations, is they're making a claim for privilege on the basis of fairness. But they know this won't work in a world in which equality is the dominant principle, so they couch their arguments in the language of equality. It's equality that should give them privilege. It would be a more equal world if you had southern states on the Security Council, more non-Western states. But most people see through these justifications, but they're nevertheless a sign of the nature of change. The second shorter-term account or explanation for the collapse of orders has to do with rule packages. In most orders, the higher up you go on the status or pecking ladder, the thicker the rule packages, and they're designed to restrain elites. So if we come back to Thumos-based worlds with the principle of fairness, and I can offer you ancient Greece and Ming China, or 18th century France as the quintessential examples of this, there's a tacit deal. Those at the top receive honor from those at the bottom. And in Ming China, we were all formalized in terms of kowtowing and paying tribute, very simple tribute. And in return, those at the top assume responsibilities in a practical way for looking after those beneath them. Right? So Ming China offered very favorable trade arrangements with the states that surrounded it, and it also provided security for them and protected their independence. So to the extent that the powerful lived according to their rule packages and, above all, exercised self-restraint, the smaller fry benefited and everybody was happy. And the same was true with hegemony in ancient Greece or with aristocracy in 18th century France. In fact, Tocqueville was among the first to observe that in appetite worlds, the people who become wealthy, there are no rules and norms that say that they have responsibility for those beneath them. And he wondered whether this could not lead to the worst kind of tyranny that the world had ever seen. This is the downside of materialism, in contrast to the liberal sort of rosy view of its benefits. And what I do in the book is to show that in appetite worlds and in thumos-based worlds, that there are different pathways that lead to decline. But in both, elites, well, in the thumos-based world, elites stop honoring the rule packages. And others become worried about their ability to gain honor or even to have security. And ultimately, you have a point where there's enough fear that you go from a reason-based into a fear-based world, and people begin to prepare for the worst, and somebody preempts. In the appetite world, those at the top decide they no longer need to live by the rules. They cheat on their taxes. Look in the United States, or even in Britain, who pays taxes? The poorer you are, the higher percentage you end up paying, despite, in theory, the tax code. they behave in egregious ways. One of the examples I use in the book is two Hollywood moguls who had houses on Malibu Beach, which is a public beach, but paid contractors to wall off the entrance for the public, so they couldn't get there to turn it into a private beach. It went to court. They lost. It became a huge issue in California. I give examples in rural China of where this kind of exploitation has routinely led to riots of people who are willing to put up with a lot, but not this in-your-face abuse of their position. And ultimately, that leads to emulation and then to a breakdown of order. So if the rich people cheat on their taxes, why can't I? And they don't follow the rules, why should I? I'm not a chump. And my amour propre is offended if I do it and they get away with it. And once that happens, all kinds of law and nomos breaks down. And then, once again, you move into a fear-based world. Now, in practice, in the modern world, they're not either-or. They're not appetite or thumos-based worlds. They're combinations of both. We're all concerned with self-esteem. We're all, to a degree, concerned with material well-being. Lots of studies indicate that once we reach a certain level of affluence, and it doesn't have to be very high, according to Ron Engelhardt, and people are asked, do you prefer your next increment to be in status or wealth? It begins to shift. People want status. And above a certain point in income, status wins like 90% of the time. So both are there. If we look at the West, I'm going to make two arguments now that relate to my empirical case of the United States. Argument number one is that Tocqueville was right, that in appetite worlds, people become more concerned with acquisition and frame their circle more narrowly to either themselves, their family, or their immediate friends, and care nothing for the rest of society, and don't feel they have any responsibility for it. So selfishness, what he calls privativism, becomes increasingly dominant. And secondly, there's been this shift from fairness to equality, but it's unevenly distributed. And I argue it's particularly unevenly distributed in the United States. And I have these two chapters in which I attempt to document this empirically. Before I do, Christopher, when did I begin? Where am I in my timing?
Well, technically, you have 10 more minutes.
So you have okay. Yeah, I think I could try to do it.
You so, have to be too literal.
Well, but I don't want to hog the time. So to look at this shift to selfishness, I've looked at several discourses. Presidential inaugural and State of the Union addresses, because they're the ones that are most carefully crafted and designed most to appeal to wider audiences. And then popular culture, popular music, and TV sitcoms. And I've looked at these from the end of World War II until the present. And I looked with the presidential inaugurals and State of the Unions, I looked at everyone. And I worked out with my students a set of coding rules that would tell us the extent to which presidents were appealing to selfishness versus common good. So some of you may remember, I do, I was a university student at the time when Kennedy was elected. And one of his more memorable phrases, all the newspapers thought, was when he told the American people, do not ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That kind of rhetoric today would be laughed off the stage by the public. So I looked at the extent to which presidents appeal on the basis of the common good, or this will be better for you individually or your family. I looked at the extent to which they thought that individuals needed to cooperate with others to achieve these ends, or could do so themselves. I have 5 tests. And I had a group of students who coded, and we met on a regular basis, went over the data, and where there were differences of opinion, we discussed it, ultimately sort of came around to a consensus. And I did the same with popular music. There's a list of the top 100 songs in every decade. And I coded the top 10. 40s, 50s, on up through the decade that ended with 2010. And here, too, I had a series of questions. Many of these songs are about love. So to what extent was there a mutual identification as opposed to my satisfaction? To what extent was the song relationship-based, as opposed to just about sex? To what extent were more general norms of the society brought into the song in analyzing the relationship of the people who were involved? And with my sitcoms, I started in the 1950s, because there really weren't any in the 1940s, with I Love Lucy, which some of you may have seen, and I ended with 2 sitcoms in the, actually I do go past 2010, 2 sitcoms, American, this is all American of course, one was, why am I forgetting the name, the show about Modern Family, which set in California, with, among other things, a gay couple, funky kind of family. They're all clearly politically liberal, relatively well off. And the second one, the name will come to me, is set in Arkansas, in a rural area where the family are duck hunters, but have made a lot of money because they've invented a duck call that they manufacture and send around the world. They're anti-modern. They have very traditional family structure. And it turns out that the Modern Family was the show that had the highest percentage of Democrats watching it in America over any other show. And something Dynasty. I'll get the name, is the show that has the highest Republican audience. So very different shows. And what I'm able to show is, again, I look at how individuals frame their interests. Do they do it selfishly or part of the group? Do they try to advance their interest at the expense of the group or together with the group? To what extent do they show empathy for other people? To what extent are activities individual as opposed to group? And in each of these decades and in each of these discourses, there is a sharp decline from a collective sense to an individual sense. In the case of the presidential speeches, it doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in power. The one outlier was Jimmy Carter, who was a little more collective than everybody else. And for the second aspect of this, the equality fairness, I content analyzed quantitatively and qualitatively the campaign speeches of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And I did so, I had a program that identified the most common words once I got rid of all the articles and various other things. I looked at nouns mostly. And I then combined them where they were similar words like country, nation, clearly meant the same thing. And the results were absolutely striking. Hillary Clinton talked most of the time about equality and various forms of it. And Trump talked about fairness. And if you consider Make America Great Again, he's talking about a hierarchy in which America is at the top because it contributes the most to the world. It's your classic fairness hierarchy. And in coded ways, the audience to which he was appealing, and I do my best to document this, are white males, Protestant, who have come from families who have been in America a long time, who feel that their status has precipitously declined and that they're being discriminated against in favor of women, minorities, African Americans, that this is unfair. So two different audiences, two different principles of justice. In a highly polarized country that's polarized by region and by urban-rural splits. And this, in the most fundamental way, accounts for the culture war that you see in the United States. I then, and I don't want to go on much longer, identify five stages that orders go through when they collapse, drawing on a range of historical cases. And I look at the extent to which, where is the U.S., on this scale. And I'll stop there, read the book, and you'll find out what conclusion I come to. The China case is interesting. I'm going to stop in about 3 minutes. China case is interesting because almost all Western analyses of China are done so through the liberal democratic framework. So, of course, China is an unstable regime, and its government will not be able to survive. Now, I think that that's not a fair way of looking at China because it prejudges the outcome. So I've done something that's utterly counterintuitive. To find a different framework, I have the first of the two chapters on China is really on Georgian Britain. I argue that these two countries, Georgian Britain and contemporary China, show utterly remarkable similarities, that you have revolution, new regime in both countries. It's resisted on the peripheries and also by groups that find support in foreign country, offshore in the case of China, onshore France in the case of Georgian Britain. You have an elite that's completely authoritarian, that uses all kinds of methods to maintain itself in power and suppress dissent. It is utterly corrupt in Britain and China. It uses its political power to place its children in important economic positions so that they can continue family dominance in politics and economy, which become hard to separate. There are hundreds of violent protests in the countryside every month. The army can't be called in for quite similar reasons in both countries to put them down. Local authorities have to do so, often through bargaining, to quiet things down. Both countries undergo enormous economic change and development. And both elites only belatedly begin to recognize some of the political consequences of this development. And yet, Georgian Britain somehow transforms itself into Victorian Britain, the most democratic state and perhaps the most stable state in 19th century Europe. Now, Martin and I look at the similarities and differences. And one of the things we conclude is that the similarities are really striking, but they're more, each of these problems is more extreme in every case in China. And also critical are the different role models that people have. So for the late Georgians, the negative role model is France, and you need to do what you can to keep a revolution from going. For the Chinese leadership, the negative role model is Gorbachev's Soviet Union. If you begin to make reforms, it's all going to become, it's going to unravel. But nevertheless, in each case, but particularly in Georgia and Britain, because it's history now, elites have sought to preserve themselves and have produced radical change, not thinking that they were doing so. And we asked the extent to which that might also happen in China. And at the end of the book, well, the beginning of the book, I start with a famous quote from Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida about the nature of order. In the conclusion, I come and revisit it and make the case that definitions of order inevitably carry deep tensions within them, and that rather than trying to squeeze them out the way social scientists do, that we benefit from these tensions. And I draw out what these tensions are, and I suggest a research agenda growing out of this for further examination of political order. Thanks.
Well, we're going to open it up to questions, and when you ask a question, will you stand and just identify yourself? But before we go any further, what are the 5 points you're going to make about the United States?
No, let's do the questions now.
But that is my question.
Oh, so, all right. So let me see if I remember them all. So the first point is that you have the beginnings of a deep polarization, and that clearly is true in the United States, and that the deep polarization reflects different expectations about principles of justice and which apply, so that in effect people have contrasting views that are hard to reconcile about the nature of order. The third is that comity declines sharply in this circumstance, that there's very much less tolerance for those with whom you disagree. And I'll simply tell, if I may, a little personal story on this. So in the Carter administration, I was an advisor to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Jimmy Carter lost the election. Admiral Turner, the head of the CIA, became a lame duck. I became a dead duck. I had to find another job. And I was still looking for one when the Republicans came to power and Bill Casey came into the director's office. And he said, "Why are you still here?" And I said, "Well, I haven't found a job yet." He said, "Oh," he said, "that we understand." He said, "Look, stay on as long as you want until you find a job. We want you to pay your mortgage, but I'm moving you out of the director's office." And that was interesting because I spent the rest of my time in the psychiatric shop that study the personalities and sex lives of foreign leaders, and that'll have to be another lecture. My youngest son worked for Mike Honda, who was the Democratic representative from San Jose, California. David went to Stanford. It was his local congressman. And he was head of the Transportation Committee. David was in the habit of going on Friday afternoons to the office of a Republican senator. Why? Because his interns, three of whom were attractive women, had home-baked cookies and soda pop and socialized, so he met people. The third week he did this, one of the women said, "How dare you come here? We've discovered you're a Democrat." So that's what's happened in the Congress. So this third stage has come along as well. Now, the fourth stage is when people increasingly frame issues as matters of principle rather than matters of interest. Because matters of interest you can always compromise on and feel that, you know, you've done a deal. Matters of principle are much more difficult to compromise. Think about abortion as a case in point in the United States. And the next stage is when one faction or another gets hold of the levers of government and uses them to suppress or punish their opponents. And that's begun to happen in the U.S. and certainly has in states where Republicans have been in control. Case in point is Wisconsin, where the Democrats captured the governorship again, but the Republicans controlled the legislature and used it to strip the governor of all of his powers. Right? So this is using the levers of power in ways that violate the Constitution, either written or unwritten, to try to lock in power. And the sixth stage is when people go out on the streets in protest. So the U.S. has gone far down this line. I, for one, am nevertheless hopeful that the glass is half full rather than half empty, and that a new election will bring new people into power, and that the country will have learned, and the democratic institutions in the long run may become strengthened. That's the narrative I'd like to believe. It was a long-winded answer. I apologize.
It was very, very useful, and will prevent many people buying your book this evening. I'm sorry about that.
That's quite all right.
You wouldn't include yourself amongst the 30% of Americans who think there'll be a civil war during their life.
No, I don't think, I'm hoping there won't be. The other thing that's interesting is that 30% of Americans think that Jesus is going to reappear in their lifetime and in the United States.
That might be more likely. Let's open it up to the floor. Yes, do we have a microphone? Can you just wait until the microphone?
My name is Elizabeth. I'm doing hold
the mic a little closer.
My name is Elizabeth. I'm doing an MSc in conflict studies here.
Yes.
And just last week, we had a public lecture by John Mersheimer.
My former student.
Really?
Yes.
Very interesting. Yes. And he also talked about political order, but in a very different sense.
Yes, he did.
And his thesis basically was that nationalism will always trump over liberalism. And I'm wondering how this conflict of nationalism and liberalism fits into your discourse or the discourse that you just introduced of equality versus fairness.
Good. That's a very good question. Let me start by saying that John is Dick Rosecrans was his thesis advisor, but I was on his committee and had been one of his professors at Cornell. I like John. He's a very nice man. He's generous in his opinions. He respects people who disagree with him. And I am one of them. And I would point out that every prediction he has ever made is wrong. So it's, how do I put this? So he should do the equivalent of issuing a stock newsletter telling you what to buy, and if John suggests you should buy it, sell. And the other way around works. So when the Cold War ended, he said it was going to lead to really renewed great power conflict, that Germany and Japan should and would develop nuclear weapons, that NATO would collapse. Now, maybe Trump will, in the end, make that happen. But every one of his predictions was wrong, and I see no reason to think that this one will be right. John is narrowly focused on his understanding of power. He ignores culture, history, everything else, and his understanding of power is utterly crude. It's entirely military capabilities. And in fact, material capabilities are one source of power. And power is only one source of influence. The world is far more complex. And the political order has many props to it, aside from the ones that he goes after. Now, it's undoubtedly true that liberalism is in crisis. But it doesn't necessarily follow that even democracy will collapse and that nationalism will triumph the way it did in the 1930s. And indeed, one of the reasons for that is that people in many countries have very live memories of what happened in the 1930s, or at least those of you who are younger and don't remember. Well, I remember World War II. I started school in 1945. I know, it's a long time ago. I just finished my 53rd year of university teaching. But those of you who are younger have read about this, and that makes a big difference. You can't just make these linear predictions.
Hi there. Thank you for coming, Professor. I'm Joel Rose, and I was an alumnus here. So I just have a very simple question for you. So is it about scale in terms of political orders? You talked about Thumos. You talked about the appetite of order. And we've got political theories such as, you know, Jean-Jacques Rousseau saying there's only a certain size you should have a polity, because then the sort of communal links start to break down, people start cheating, you start to get global elites behaving like this. So is it really about scale? Is it really sort of new Kennedyan thesis of you reach a certain size and then things start to break down because you no longer have those bonds of fairness?
Okay. So that's a very good question. So size is important, but not critical. So let me turn to the Federalist Papers. Opponents to the American Constitution made exactly that argument. They said, look, the only successful democracies in the world have been city-states. Here we have a vast country, and the 13 colonies were already vast before the country even began to expand. How can we possibly have a sense of community in a democracy this way? And Madison Jay and Hamilton wrote a powerful argument, most notably in Federalist Number 10. And they argued that there are two problems that threaten democracy. Minority factions motivated by interest, appetite, right? And majority factions motivated by passion, thumos. They'll always exist, but they're far less likely to become dominant in a large country that is geographically diverse, where people are separated from one another. And, of course, in those days, they didn't have media, let alone social media, to link everybody together, so that the country will benefit from its size. So I think it works both ways. And if we look, for example, in Europe, one of the things we found is that people identify much more as Europeans than they ever did in previous decades. But at the same time, there's a kind of anomie and alienation that comes from largeness and displacement. So Europeans also identify more than they have in earlier decades with their local regions. You know, they feel Bayerisch, you know, Bavarian, or we have a place in Tuscany. And they don't feel Tuscan, but they certainly have a loyalty to Cortona, and make jokes about people south of them from Perugia or north of them at Arezzo. There's this fierce local pride, and that becomes all the more necessary in this larger world. And there's no reason why people can't do both. So you have, like Matryoshka dolls, nested identifications. And to the extent to which those are made compatible rather than put in opposition, and that's exactly what Brexit's done the latter in this country, alas, then people can feel comfortable in these larger political units. And they also have bottom-up orders. And bottom-up orders, there are many of them, and they allow people to associate in a human way with others. So you have a politics of scale.
Well, other people are thinking what to say. Can I just ask one question, and then Pete, I'll come to you, if I may. I was very interested in what you said about primates, because a new book has just come out by a Harvard professor called Origins.
Oh, yeah.
In which he's taking to task both Rousseau and Hobbes.
Right.
Rousseau for saying that we are naturally peaceful, and Hobbes for saying that we're naturally violent, and because he's saying we're both.
Absolutely.
And the link is language. Because what language enables you to do is, A, inhabit the future. You can actually talk about things other than they are at the moment. And as you know, neuroscientists will tell us that we spend between 25 and 50% of every day thinking about the future rather than today. We're doing tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. And language also enables you to enunciate concepts of fairness and justice in a way that enables you to, in a sense, imagine different societies. Whereas primates do indeed have this instinctive sense of fairness and justice, but they're not imagining a different society.
So this is interesting. I fundamentally agree with the argument. It's very clear now from physical anthropological work on early societies that violence was very high. There's no idealistic utopian world that Rousseau imagined before the development of reason and private property, which is the dividing point in his world. This is a fiction. But nor is the world anything like realists imagine, anarchical and a war of all against all. I mean, there's a society, there are norms. Most people in most states behave according to them much of the time. And I would argue, in contrast to, let's say, Quentin Skinner and Richard Tuck, when I read Hobbes, that Hobbes never meant his state of nature to be a description of any reality. It's a thought experiment. It's showing what happens to people when you extract them from society, that they become a bundle of raw appetites and instrumental reason, that they're a danger to everybody else and above all to themselves. Mozart and De Ponte make the same argument about Don Giovanni, and both these arguments ultimately come from the Greeks, and Hobbes is a close reader of the Greeks and a translator of Thucydides from where he gets it. So, yes, it's complicated. Now, with human beings and animals, and here I'm on a little difficult ground because I'm not an ethologist. I've merely read some of the literature, but that's all. My sense is that that many animals, and certainly bonobos and chimps, are able to imagine at least the short-term future. And it's why it's one of the... If you're going to have equality and fairness internalized, and most people behave, or animals behave according to them, you have to be able to imagine the future. The two go together. What animals can't do is, of course, theorize about it, because they lack the kind of language that we have. And the future, it's very interesting, and here I come to Aristotle, in contrast to Darwin and his successors, made what I think is a fundamental distinction between, well, there are many pairs, but let me take fright and fear. So fright, you turn a corner, and there's a mugger with a knife. That's fright. You get a physical reaction, you know, adrenaline starts flowing, there's an immediate threat, and that's true for animals as well. Aristotle distinguished it from fear. Fear is something you imagine might happen to you in the future. It's mediated by thought. And it becomes an interesting question whether certain kinds of higher primates are able to have fear or just fright. And it would be very interesting to try to devise some experiments to tease this out.
And a later book, Martha Nussbaum, also takes that a little further, saying that fear makes you angry with the person who has created fear in you, whereas fright, we're not angry about snakes, for example.
Okay, that's right.
And anger leads to revenge.
Yeah, no, that's so, right.
Anyway. Peter.
So origins, I should read.
Yes.
Peter Wilson, Department of International Relations. Ned, I was very intrigued by your comparison between Georgian Britain and contemporary China. It seems to me that Georgian Britain had a few advantages. One is a free press. Another is an independent judiciary. Another, perhaps, is a very small land army. And a fourth is independent universities. Not very many of them, but the ones that existed were independent. China doesn't have those advantages, which makes me think that the road to democracy and free institutions will be a much more rocky one there than it was in Georgian Britain.
Well, I agree with your conclusion. I'm not at all optimistic about China becoming democratic, nor am I optimistic about its authoritarian regime surviving. However, I think that you make too much of these differences, because it was only late in Georgian Britain that there was a free press. For much of it, the courts were under the thumb of the government and consistently brought political verdicts. It was only later that they became more independent, and certainly justices of the peace, when you got out to the shires, were no different from their Chinese counterparts. Universities, yes, certainly freer, although not free in the sense that we know them today. But here, too, I come back to Martin Dimitrov's point that the truth lies somewhere in between, that Britain was closer to China than we think, but China took every one of these things from corruption to suppression to a much higher degree. And that, so the differences of degree, not of kind, are what is important.
Well, can I just take you a little further on China? I know you didn't want to be drawn too much on China.
Yeah, because I'm not an expert. I'm only repeating what Martin says.
When we were in the green room just having a chat, I mentioned I just reviewed this book on Broken Powers.
Right.
By Julia Lovell.
Big book, too.
It's a very big book, yes, at the University of London University. And she has a very interesting observation at the end. She was talking to a taxi driver in Beijing, who's quite old, and lived through the Cultural Revolution. And she said, what do you think of today's China? And he said, well, you know, the one thing Mao did was that he made us all equal. We weren't grumbling for cash all the time. Beggars weren't demanding money from you all the time. And now things are different. And she said, so, you'd like to turn the clock back to the 1960s? And he immediately said, no, I want an education. And I want an education for my children. So he said that I don't want equality of outcome, I want equality of opportunity.
This is the newer version.
Which led her to say that China is not Maoist, but Mao-ish.
It's a very good way of putting it.
And that the party is obviously sticking with Mao for the time being, and iconography and symbolism, etc. But the party's problem, of course, is that equality of opportunity requires constant economic growth. And now you're seeing it slowing down. So where does economic growth come into your equation? Because you haven't said much about economics.
So I'm going to finesse this question because I'm not an economist. And I may be a polymath in some ways, but one of the fields about which I know the least is economics. I've focused much more on the cultural, political, intellectual side of things. I've certainly read a lot of the literature that goes into the economic arguments about China, and I find it very interesting. I have no independent way of judging them.
Just one in front.
Here's Mike. Tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Matt. I work in marketing at a secondary school in London. I just came out of interest. I was just curious, as countries go through rise and then fall, do you see any processes for rebirth, renewal, or
yes.
that can keep them? You're an optimist.
Yes.
So you must have a...
Yeah. No, there's no doubt that... We have numerous examples of countries in decline that reversed themselves. And one of the things that's interesting here that I didn't have time to go to in the lecture, in which I use China and Georgian Britain and the United States and other countries as examples, is it's very important what people think about the robustness of their political order. Well, thinking it's robust can be self-fulfilling. In other circumstances, thinking it's robust can blind you to decline and keep you from acting in ways to prevent disaster. I mean, just look at climate change deniers as an example of that. And believing that your order is in the decline can hasten its decline, especially if your opponents know that you believe that. But thinking your order is in decline can also provide the incentive to do things about it. So here, too, rather than starting with economic data or measures of power, I start with what's in people's heads. And I try to look at the conditions that make people aware of the need for change. And I also suggest that there's a second level to this, because the judgments people make about the robustness of their order often bear no relationship to the truth. And even very clever people do this. So my favorite example is David Hume, who's one of my great idols. I've just finished writing something about him for another book. So David Hume, late 1770s, I think he died. Toward the end of his life, he wrote an essay about France, and he argued that France was far and away the most stable state in Europe and would endure for a very long time this royal order. And by contrast, Georgian Britain was perhaps the most unstable state in Britain, and he feared then in the next 20 or 30 years, there'd be a revolution, okay? Now, this is David Hume, who spent a lot of time in France, spoke French, he's in Britain, he's thoughtful, he's right about so many things, he's very wrong here. And we, of course, only know in retrospect whether orders are stable or not, or where they are on the robustness decline. So it's very hard, and I wouldn't pretend to have the answer to say that this contemporary judgment is right or wrong. But looking at how people think about them is very clearly the place to start. And then the second question is what they think has to be done to make the order robust. And there, too, I'm arguing that this is difficult to know, but certainly to the extent to which we can document the shift from fairness to equality, and the degree to which it's even or lumpy in a society, begins to tell us about the ability to make changes that might address it and what kinds of changes might work. That's in the conclusion to the book.
Thank you very much. Alexander Evans, I work for the Foreign Office. I was curious, you know, there's been mention of the future and how states or societies think about the future. Is it relevant in terms of how societies or societal elites think about the future when you're dealing with the question of a state in the international society, be it in a decline context or indeed in a growth context?
No, I think it is. So much of policy is a function of what people think is going to happen in the future. Let me just give you one foreign policy example. There was a huge difference of opinion in the Nixon years between Henry Kissinger, first National Security Advisor, then Secretary of State, and James Schlesinger, who was Secretary of Defense. Schlesinger opposed the arms control deal that Nixon was negotiating because Nixon and Kissinger worked on the assumption that the U.S. was a declining power militarily and the Soviet a rising one. So they were willing to give the Soviet Union an advantage because it would lock it in, and it would prevent changes that would further increase the Soviet advantage. Schlesinger saw the U.S. as the rising power in comparison to the Soviet Union and was absolutely unwilling to accept an arms control agreement that wasn't fully equal. And that's just one of many examples. And what happens here, and this is very difficult to ferret out empirically, is that we have many instances in many countries where people's estimates of the future honestly shape their policy preferences. And we have other cases where people reach policy preferences for completely different reasons, but justify it on the basis of future scenarios, because they can sell it to others. And politics is ultimately about selling your ideas and policies to other people. So either rhetorically or substantively, the future is involved in the present. Yeah, I know who you are.
Hi, my name is Martin. I'm a second-year student of IR at King's. So my question is, in terms of the applicability of your framework of appetite, thumos, and reason in today's world, more than 70 years after the Second World War, do you think it's problematic that you, as well as the scholars on whom you draw most, namely Thucydides, Clausewitz, Morgenthau, were all heavily influenced by major power wars. So on the contrary, for instance, in Confucian political philosophy, the notion of compassion as a human drive plays an important role, which has also been picked up by feminist IR scholars who, for instance, have promoted a similar idea in the notion of the ethics of care.
Okay. So this is a very good question. Let me try to answer it in parts. Yes, indeed. Some of the people I write about are writing in the aftermath of wars. Thucydides, Clausewitz, Hans Morgenthau, cases in point, even David Hume. And I'm interested in them because they're writing when orders have been challenged or even destroyed, and it becomes necessary to think about ways of reconstituting. And the people I've picked, whom I classify as classical realists, are people who recognize that you can't, a la Edmund Burke, Leo Strauss, roll the clock back. History has moved on. These values are no longer accepted. Nor can you move directly, let me use a Brexit phrase here, into the sunny uplands. Utopian notions of the future are equally futile, and attempts to put them in place are likely to produce more damage than good. So what they've tried to do, and why I find them appealing, is that they've tried to figure out ways of combining the best of the past with what they think is the most promising of the future, and in a way that it becomes politically palatable and realistic as a project. That I find very appealing, and as my interest was in order, these seemed to me people who spoke to my question. Now, I'll go a further point with this, and I have addressed only Western thinkers. And a couple of the reviews of Tragic Vision of Politics, and I think even of cultural theory, accuse me of being not only just Western in my view, but also taking an ancient Greek understanding of the mind and just applying it across the board to other cultures. And my counter to this is that if we go backwards here, that what the Greeks are describing is, I think, universal attributes of human beings. What I'm the first to admit, and I elaborate in detail, is that in different historical periods, in different cultures, appetite and thumos find different forms of expression. Well, they're culturally specific, and their relative importance is also culturally and historically specific. So one can take a concept that originated in one place and use it as a kind of ideal type or a framework to study other societies. And secondly, I limit myself to the West because my knowledge of languages and culture is Western, and it would be a mistake for me to write about cultures I don't know about, which is why I recruited Martin Dimitrov to do the China chapter. Now, there's compassion, there's friendship, there are a whole range of other values that enter into human relationships, which are very important. I by no means wish to exclude them. One of my former PhDs and former postdocs, Felix Behrenskirt, who got his degree here at LSE and teaches at SOAS, has written extensively, and he's finishing a book now, on friendship in international relations and its importance. I don't claim to be dealing with the universe of emotions. What I've done is to pick those that I think are most relevant to international relations. That's all. Lots of room for people to talk about others.
Thank you for your talk. Sorry for the specificity of this question.
Just tell me who you are.
Oh, sorry. I'm Stephen.
I'm a civil servant.
Yeah.
Can you identify in the comparison between the comparison of Athens in Herodotus and the Athens of Thucydides, a transition from equality and fairness in Thucydides, which leads to the breakdown of that specific state system and society?
So I don't think so. I don't think that Herodotus is flogging the principle of equality. I think that he is as much committed to the notion of fairness as Thucydides, and that if anything, Thucydides shows greater awareness of the value of equality, especially in Athens. And that this clash of fairness and equality is a real source of political turmoil in the Greek world more generally, which Thucydides and certainly more Aristotle talk about.
As we're going on for time, can I just ask the last two questions very quickly?
You're the boss.
Thank you. What's the response, your response to Fukuyama's point in the end of History and the Last Man, that Thumos is these days to be found in the underprivileged, the outcasts, and the outsiders, particularly gangs in inner city streets who are still unwilling to demand respect and honour, and if they don't get it, are willing to turn to the warrior qualities? And the other, perhaps even more controversial one from your favourite writer, Tocqueville, is that you can't have a democracy without an aristocracy, and that he identified the lawyers as the aristocratic class.
Yes, indeed he did.
Which might be a kind of joke to all of us in this room, since I think lawyers have done more to probably bring the United States down from its great days than any other class. But on the other hand, you rely on them, with President Trump, to defend the Constitution. So good lawyers and bad lawyers, perhaps constitutional lawyers.
That's right. Yes, there used to be all those lawyer jokes.
Yeah.
And then they gave way to... They gave way to banker jokes. So that's really two questions. So Fukuyama is not somebody I find myself agreeing with on much of anything. Certainly he's right that one of the reasons gangs exist is not only to provide order in areas where authority has broken down, but they're also a way of gaining status, and certainly for young men for whom that becomes very important. But I wouldn't pick on gangs in particular. You could start with nation states. I've made the argument that, and Max Weber makes the argument, that what most international competition and conflict is about is honor and claims for status among states. So from gangs to nations, at every level of social interaction, thumos is a very important motive. Now, what is interesting, and here's where we talk about, you know, honor among thieves, that seeming oxymoron, is that for the Greeks, honor can only be achieved through rule-based competition, which is why wrestlers and other Olympic athletes were naked, because judges could see much more easily if they did something unfair. And even if you lose, if you've played well, you gain honor. Think about some years ago at the Winter Olympics, how everyone was enamored of the Jamaican bobsled team, as a case in point. The competition for honor is, however, very fierce, and as Hobbes observed, it's a relational quality. If everybody had honor, nobody would. So the competition is fierce, and there's a temptation to cheat. And once people cheat, you have incentives to cheat as well, and the system can rapidly unravel. The rules fall aside, and it becomes simply a game of who's at the top of the hill by whatever means. If you look at what happened to European politics between 1875 and 1914, this is the process. And this, to my way of thinking, is an underlying, very important underlying cause of World War I. And honor among thieves, sometimes they respect one another and compete according to the rules, and sometimes it breaks down, as with Mexican drug lords, for example, and all hell breaks loose. So there are sharp parallels here, and Fukuyama is, I think, mistaken on seeing gangs as the last holdout of this kind of activity.
And the Tocqueville?
Oh, yes. So Tocqueville was very clear, he thought, that the excesses of appetite worlds encouraged by democracies, the most effective and maybe the only way of restraining them was through the creation of the kind of aristocracy that democracies would respect. And here he pointed to lawyers as the example. And remember, he's in 1830s America. And lawyers, even then, were the people who got elected to office. They're the people who brought comedy into politics, as they had in law practice, where lawyers trust one another and the court process requires them to do so. And they did so in politics as well. And his hope was that the ethic associated with aristocracy, which was embodied in the legal profession, could spread from law to politics and act as an important source of self-restraint. Of course, today we would say it hasn't, but on the other hand, as you've pointed out, to the extent to which the Republic is going to be saved from Donald Trump, there are two sources by which it can happen: the electorate in the next election, and the courts. And the courts, even Republican judges, have consistently behaved, not consistently, have largely behaved to uphold the law. And it's quite striking when you have the few who don't. One example being the famous Texas judge who all the conservatives go to because they know he's committed to his form of conservatism and the Constitution be damned, and he's the one who recently declared all of Obama's Health Care Act, Obamacare, unconstitutional. My guess is when it comes up to the Supreme Court, that John Roberts, who's committed to the Constitution and to his place in history, question of looking into the future, is going to uphold Obamacare. So the courts are extremely important in the United States.
Well, thanks very much. And before, yep. Before everybody goes, could I just make, and before we thank you formally, can I just make two points? We have a talk coming up on the 23rd of January from the European Commissioner, EU Commissioner for Migration and Home Affairs, talking about the challenges of migration in a globalized world. So you might be interested in that. And then we have a China on the 29th of January. This is with the China Development Society, and it's about... He said it is trap and China's peaceful rights. But thank you very much for attending, and can I thank you for a wonderful talk.
Thank you very much.